Today, we enter a decidedly different section of the book of Joshua than what we have studied up to this point. The land has, to a sufficient enough degree, been conquered. Now it's time to settle it. It's time to turn the implements of war into plowshares. Now, for me, this is a difficult section because I strained to find the theological value in what on the surface seems to be little more than several consecutive chapters that center primarily on geography and tribal boundary lines. Yet because of the fundamental God patterns that the Lord has established for us in the Torah, when we can get beyond, or maybe it's beneath, these long, tedious lists of ancient cities and rivers and mountains and kings, suddenly the reasons for their presence in the Holy Scriptures starts to surface. Now, what we're going to see develop in the next few chapters of Joshua is that despite the general statement that the Bible pronounces that Joshua conquered all the land, in fact, he did not. And this is but one example of why, after our first coming to belief in the God of Israel and his Messiah Yeshua, we must move as quickly as possible beyond our naive belief in overly simplified doctrines and into a greater maturity and understanding by diligently studying God's Word from the beginning. That is, the Bible is full of generalizations that were but cultural, Hebrew cultural, in their nature and in their form. But then as we read closer, we find these generalizations are expanded upon with more details, caveats, nuances. See, the Hebrew way in the Holy Scripture seems to be that a broad generalization is pronounced first, then afterwards the details that shape its edges are added. If we stop studying and become satisfied with only the generalizations, then we get only part of the truth. And thus we have a much harder time grasping what follows and placing it into application in our own lives. So in a certain sense, everything that happens from this point forward in the remainder of the Bible, Old and New Testaments, is about the consequences of Joshua and the Israelites and their descendants failing to trust God and fully conquer the promised land. I have stated on numerous occasions that the intractable Middle East that we see today is a direct result of Israel's inability to follow through with the conquering of Canaan. Yet in our era, we can now also see in ways more visible than in any time since the advent of Yeshua that the failures of Joshua and those Israeli leaders who followed him have also led to the permanent state of confusion and conflict that seems to have gripped the entire globe. And of course, at every turn, the solutions proposed by the various world governing bodies for this conflict over Israel violate Yehovah's commandments and covenants and are not in harmony with the universe he created, and so they lead to nothing but more violence and war. Peace by means of compromise and tolerance will never work when it comes to God's land and to his people. So the key to our study of the remaining chapters of Joshua is to approach it from the correct angle. And that angle is all wrapped up in recognizing the consequences of an incomplete victory that comes from the incomplete trust and lack of obedience. Consequences that all of God's people will suffer until Messiah comes again. So to set the tone for today's lesson, I want you to open your Bibles to a New Testament book, the book of 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, We're going to chapter 10, page 1431. We're going to take a look at 1 Corinthians 10, verses 1 through 13. Page 1431 with the complete Jewish Bible. For brothers, I don't want you to miss the significance of what happened to our fathers. All of them were guided by the pillar of cloud. They all passed through the sea. And in connection with the cloud and with the sea, they all immersed themselves into Moses. Also, they all ate the same food from the Spirit. They all drank the same drink from the Spirit, for they drank from a Spirit-sent rock which followed them, and that rock was the Messiah. Yet with the majority of them, God was not pleased, so their bodies were strewn across the desert. Now, these things took place as a prefigurative historical event, warning us not to set our hearts on evil things like they did. Don't be idolaters, as some of them were. As the Tanakh puts it, the people sat down to eat and drink and then got up to indulge in revelry. Let us not engage in sexual immorality, as some of them did, with the consequence that 23,000 died in a single day. And let's not put the Messiah to the test, as some of them did, and they were destroyed by snakes. And don't grumble, as some of them did, and they were destroyed by the destroying angel. These things happened to them as prefigurative historical events, and they were written down as a warning to us who are living in the Acharit Hayamim. Therefore, let anyone who thinks he is standing up be careful not to fall. No temptation has seized you beyond what people normally experience, and God can be trusted not to allow you to be tempted beyond what you can bear. On the contrary, along with the temptation, he will also provide the way out so that you will be able to endure. Paul says that he and his generation are living out what was started in the previous generations, or as he puts it, what happened to our fathers. And he says in verse 6 that what went on, especially with Moses and the Exodus and then entering into the Promised Land, was prefigurative of what the life of a disciple of Jesus Christ can expect. And that's because it's all connected and intertwined. Now that we've heard from Paul on the subject, I can do no better than to paraphrase Richard Hess, who says this about the section of Joshua we are just about to enter. He says this: for the believer, Israel's inability to fully and completely conquer all the promised land looks ahead to our present day inability to enjoy the fullest favor of God's available blessings in this life. Christians are not perfect, even though we are called to display perfect holiness. We live in this impossible tension between the rewards of a life lived as directed by the Holy Spirit of God, and these rewards are available here and now, and our own failures that effectively block our access to these same rewards that we so desperately seek. This maddening paradox of the believer's life, sadly, has no resolution in our current state of being, or in this world as it currently exists. But we do have the promise of God's continual presence in the life of a believer that both allows us to receive forgiveness for our failures and power to live a life of obedience to the Lord. So, with that as a background, let's read Joshua chapter 12. Joshua chapter 12. Joshua chapter 12. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is on page 254. And get ready for a lot of names. Matter of fact, I'm going to have a drink of water first. These are the kings of the land, whom the people of Israel defeated and of whose land they took possession, across the Jordan towards the east, from the Arnon Valley to Mount Hermon and all the Arabah eastward. Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon and ruled the territory that includes Aroer on the edge of the Arnon Valley, the middle of the valley, half of Gilead to the Yabbok River, which forms the border with the people of Ammon, the Arabah to Lake Kinneret, eastward, and to the Sea of the Arabah, the Dead Sea, eastward by way of Bet Yeshmot, and on the south under the slopes of Pisgah. There was also the territory of Og, king of Bashan, who belonged to the remnant of the Rephaim. He lived in Ashtaroth and at Edrei, and he ruled Mount Hermon. Salkah, all of Bashan to the border with the Geshurites and the Mahakati, half of Gilead to its border with Sihon, king of Heshbon. Moses, the servant of Adonai, with the people of Israel, defeated them. And Moses, the servant of Adonai, gave it to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh as their possession. Following are the kings of the land, whom Joshua, with the people of Israel, defeated in the area west of the Jordan, between Baal-Gad and the Lebanon Valley and the Bear Mountain that goes up to Seir. Joshua gave this land, inhabited by the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, to the tribes of Israel to possess, according to their divisions in the hills, the Shephelah, the Arabah, the mountain slopes, the desert, and the Negev. The king of Jericho, the king of Ai by Bethel, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Yarmut, the king of Lachish, the king of Eglon, the king of Gezer, the king of Debir, the king of Gader, the king of Hormah, the king of Arad, the king of Libnah, the king of Adullam, the king of Makedah, the king of Bethel, the king of Tapuah, the king of Hefer, the king of Aphek, the king of Sharon, the king of Madon, the king of Hatzor, the king of Shimron Moron, the king of Akshaf, the king of Ta'anak, the king of Megiddo, the king of Kadesh, the king of Yokneam in Carmel, the king of Dor in the region of Dor, the king of Goyim in the Gilgal, and the king of Tirzah, making a total of 31 kings. And I hope you have that memorized. Yes, there is a test. Chapter 12 is divided into two distinct divisions, verses 1 through 6, and then 7 through 24. Now, the division, interestingly, is essentially marked by the Jordan River. That is, the first six verses speak of Moses leading Israel to the land on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and then from verse 7 onward, it speaks of Joshua's victories on the western side of the Jordan River. So this is more or less a State of the Union address, and it defines where Israel stood as a nation at this point in history. It does it by explaining it in geographic terms. What part of the land of Canaan they took, and by default, what part they did not take. Now, we must always remember that what the first six verses describe is not part of the promised land. It is land that the Lord allowed the tribes of Reuben and Gad and about half of the tribe of Manasseh to have instead of their natural inheritance inside the land of Canaan. It is not clear why the Lord permitted this, but it is clear why these 2.5 Israelite tribes preferred land in the Transjordan, that is the eastern side of the Jordan, to land inside Canaan. It was beautiful. It was fertile. It was already conquered. Plus, each tribe would receive quite a large tract of territory for its own. I mean, let's face it, from a purely mathematical and practical viewpoint, the land of Canaan was not all that big. To divide it up into twelfths would make each tract pretty small. By the 2.5 tribes accepting their land and another place altogether that both gave them bigger territories, but it also meant that the land of Canaan would now be divided into 10 parts instead of 12 parts, thus affording more land for each of the other 9.5 tribes. So setting the theological implications aside seemed to be kind of a win-win for all concerned. Now, as for the land on the east side of the Jordan, this section basically explains that it runs from the river Arnon in the south to Mount Hermon in the north. Now, the river Arnon is more or less the natural boundary that separated the kingdom of Sihon from Moab. Mount Hermon is the primary source of water for the Jordan River as a result of its almost 10,000 feet elevation and resultant annual snowpack and then its melt-off. Well, now that the north-south boundary is established, verse 3 gives us the east-west boundary and of the land of the Transjordan, or more accurately, the western boundary. The east is not given, and the western boundary is the Jordan River that runs from, Jordan River Valley, rather, that runs from the Kinneret, which is later on called the Sea of Galilee, down to the Dead Sea. Well, in verse 4, the matter of the kingdom of Og is brought up. Og was the king that ruled over a kingdom called Bashan, and it was north of Sihon. Now, this is some of the most fertile prime field and pasture land in the Middle East. And so it was always a territory that was hotly contested and it was desired by surrounding nations. Israel struggled mightily to maintain control over it and really only had thorough sovereignty over it during the time of Kings David and then Solomon. Here we are reminded that King Og was himself of a race of people called the Rephaim, something you might be familiar with by now. The Rephaim were unusually big and tall people, at times called giants, particularly in the Greek translations of the Bible. The Rephaim were scattered. They did not live together as a nation. Rather, they tended to rise to power in various nations or become legendary warriors. Goliath was one of these. The idea behind these passages is that Moses set the example for Joshua to follow. He conquered land. So it's an easy transition into verse 7, whereby we see Joshua do the same thing by conquering the actual promised land. And as the first verse makes it clear, this is considered to be the land west of the Jordan River. Yet there are a couple of interesting differences between how Moses went about things and what Joshua did. First is what we've already covered. Moses conquered land that was not part of the promised land. Second is that Moses personally assigned land to Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh, and this generally according to what they had requested. Now Joshua, on the other hand, distributed the land by lots, and the drawing of the lots had already been accomplished, even though up to this point the land hadn't been assigned to each tribe. Now, the area of the promised land is given in a generality. From Baal Gad up north in the Lebanon, this is the same Lebanon that we know of today, down to Seir, known as Edom, to the south. And then, to define the east-west boundary, it speaks of the hills that rise up above the Jordan Valley on the west bank of the Jordan to the Shephelah, which is the Mediterranean coastal plain. Or from this, a long list of cities that Joshua conquered in Canaan is presented. This list is in the order of their taking, beginning with Jericho, then Ai, and then the last city to be taken, Tirzah. Now it's key to notice that if we plot these cities on a map, truthfully, not all of these places are even identifiable today, they would mostly be in the area that the world today calls the West Bank. It's ironic, isn't it? that the area that the Arab nations insist is theirs, and that Israel is largely willing to concede, is in fact the heart of the promised land. It's the foundation of the kingdom of God that Joshua had taken in battle. So the state of Israel at this point of Joshua 12 can be summed up this way. Much remains to be done. Israel has carved out a large section of land for themselves, but other areas have not been conquered. The major kings have been defeated, but many minor ones must still be dealt with. Israel has, generally speaking, won the territory, but they still must drive out the remaining inhabitants and settle it. Warfare and battle is not Israel's nature. Her natural state is to live at peace in the land the Lord has given to her. But on this planet, during this phase in the world's existence, only battle can attain the peace Israel wants and the Lord wants for her. Now that Israel has conquered Canaan, the land must be divided up among the people. So that is what's about to happen. And once that's done, Israel finally has a full and complete identity, a people set apart for God, living in a land set apart for them by God. I want to point out something that might not yet be apparent. Everything that led up to this moment in Israel's history pointed towards the distribution of the land among God's people. Conquering the land is one thing. What is done with that land, that's quite another thing. Joshua was to divide that land and give it to the people. Joshua was not to own it or personally control it as Israel's leader. Now, such a procedure was generally unknown in history up to that time. For a king or a potentate to have an enormous army capable of overthrowing entire regions, well, that meant he already had a large and established center of civilization and headquarters for control and operation. He already had fields to grow food for his army, a tax base to collect money to buy supplies for his soldiers, foundries, thousands of craftsmen to fashion weapons, and established, trained, well-organized military leadership. Israel had none of this, none of it. And for those who accept Israel's exodus from Egypt and even their conquering of Canaan, but look for natural reasons for their successes and thus don't accept the reality of the miracles, then this one goes unexplainable. How can a wandering horde of people with no country, a people with no fields for food, no foundries for making weapons, not even a center of civilization, how can they have the wherewithal to be an unstoppable conquering force over a substantial region of multiple kingdoms that were all well-entrenched, well-defended, well-funded, and many had sizable standing armies? Answer, it can't happen except by the hand of the Almighty. Well, further, when a king conquered territory, the benefit, well, it was usually meant for anybody but the people. Rather, it was to his benefit. It was to satisfy his personal ambitions, his lust for power. The people merely lived by his leave on his land. It's not that the people didn't own farmlands or businesses and so on. It's that the nation belonged entirely to the king. Yet God's plan for Israel was revolutionary. No ruler would own the land or control the nation. Rather, the land would be divided up according to tribe, and then the tribal leader would divvy it up according to clans that together formed his tribe. Then the Israelite tribal prince was called a Nasi, a chieftain, not a king. He was not royalty. He was the head, the patriarch of a very large extended family called a tribe. His first duty was to be responsible for his people's well-being. He was their father, and he was to behave that way. Just as Moses set the example for Joshua, Joshua was to have been the example for all of Israel's future leaders to follow. They were not to be kings. They were to be a council of equals, a confederation of tribes who had come from the loins of a single earthly father, Jacob, called Israel. Their loyalty was not to be to a king. It was to be to their God, Yahweh. And just as with the pagan world, it was a king who ultimately owned the nation and thus all the land of that nation. So it was that Yahweh, God of Israel, was the true king of Israel. Thus he owned the nation of Israel, all the land he had planned to give them to possess, not to own. And with this history and understanding, we can see why it is that the Lord did not want Israel to have an earthly king. Introducing such an earthly office into Israelite society changed the entire dynamic of God's relationship with his people, as well as the people's relationship with their leader. A king must have the loyalty of his people. But in God's plan for Israel, all their loyalty was to be towards him. With the advent of a human king, the people's loyalty would necessarily be a divided loyalty between the God of Israel and the king of Israel. If a human king was to be effective in this present world, he must have the loyalty and obedience of his people. Saul, the first king of Israel, was a poor king. He really didn't know how to govern as a king. David was a good king. He provided strong leadership, but he was hardly ideal. Solomon wasn't as good as his father, David, but he cared deeply for the people and he did love God. Solomon consolidated his power. He instituted heavy taxes. He worked hard to create alliances with his neighbors. Someday when we get to the narrative about the kings of Israel and we study King Solomon, I'm going to show you something that most Jews, but just a few Christians even understand. The narratives about him were designed to demonstrate that Solomon was a poor king who did not follow the Torah and the ways of the Lord. But every step of the way, each king of Israel in succession demanded more from the people and gave less to the people than the one before. In time, some of these kings even felt jealous of any loyalty the people of Israel had to the God of Israel. How'd they solve that? They introduced false gods to try and destroy their connection with the God of Israel. Who owns the land is everything, especially when it comes to Israel. Who the people give their loyalty to is everything, especially when it comes to Israel and those grafted into Israel, believers. I told you last time that the coming battle of Armageddon is literally the final battle for the land of Canaan that Joshua and then all the future leaders of Israel never completed. And with the taking of that land, there will also be the taking of the whole world by Messiah. God will once again be king, as it was always intended, and no purely human king will ever again rule on this planet. And all of this stems from the time of Joshua. Let's move on to Joshua chapter 13. Joshua chapter 13. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, we're starting on page 255. Now Joshua was old. The years had taken their toll. And Adonai said to him, "You are old and the years have taken their toll." If Joshua didn't know that. "But there is yet a great deal of land to be possessed. This is the land that still remains. All the regions of the Philistim, the Philistines, and the Geshurites. From the Shechor, which fronts Egypt, to the border of Ekron, Northward from there, the land is considered as belonging to the Canaanites. That is, the territory of the rulers of the Philistines in Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron. Also to Avim to the south, all the land of the Canaanites, Merah, which belongs to the Zidonim, as far as Aphek, and on the border with the Amorites. The land of the Givli, all of the Lebanon eastward, from Baal Gad at the foot of Mount Hermon to the entrance of Hamath. As for the inhabitants of the hills between the Lebanon and Misrephoth Maim, that is, all the Zidonim, I myself will expel them ahead of the people of Israel. All you have to do is assign it to Israel as an inheritance, as I've ordered you. So now, divide this land as an inheritance for the nine tribes and the half-tribe of Manasseh. With the half-tribe of Manasseh, the Reubenites and the Gadites received their inheritance, which Moses had given them beyond the Jordan eastward, just as Moses, the servant of Adonai, had given them. From Aroer, on the edge of the Arnon Valley, the city in the middle of the valley, all the plateau between Medva and Dibon, and all the cities of Sichon, the king of the Amorites, who ruled in Heshbon, to the border with the people of Ammon. And Gilead, the territory of the Geshurites, and Maakati, all Mount Hermon, all Bashan as far as Salkah, that is, all the kingdom of Og and Bashan, who ruled in Ashtaroth and Edrei. Og was one of those remaining from the Rephaim, whom Moses defeated and expelled. However, the people of Israel expelled neither the Geshurites nor the Maakati, with the consequence that Geshur and Maakat lived among Israel to this day. Only to the tribe of Levi did Moses give no inheritance, because the offerings made by fire for Adonai, the God of Israel, are its inheritance, as Adonai had said to Moses. Moses gave land to the tribe of the descendants of Reuben by clans. Their territory included Aroer on the edge of the Arnon Valley, the city in the middle of the valley, and all the plateau near Medva. Heshbon and its villages on the plateau, Divon, Bamot Baal, Beit Baal Mon, Yahatz, Kedemot, Mefat, Kiryat Aim, Sibma, Tzeret, Shachar at the top of the valley, Beit Peor, the slopes of Pisgah, Beit Yeshmot, all the cities of the plateau, all the kingdom of Sichon, king of the Amorites, who ruled in Heshbon. Moses defeated him with the chiefs of Midian, along with Evi, Rechem, Tsur, Hur, and Reval, the princes of Sichon who lived in the land. All, along with the others, the people of Israel killed with the sword. They also struck down Bilam, the son of Bor, who practiced divination. The Jordan formed the border for the descendants of Reuben. This was the inheritance of the descendants of Reuben by clans, with its cities and villages. Moses gave land to the tribe of Gad, to the descendants of Gad by clans. Their territory included Yazer, all the cities of Gilead, half the land of the people of Ammon as far as Aroer, fronting Rabbah, that is, from Heshbon to Ramot Mitzpeh and Betonim, and from Machanaim to the border of Lidver. While in the valley, it included Beit Haram, Beit Nimrah, Sukkot, and Tzafon. In other words, the rest of the kingdom of Sichon, king of Heshbon, with the Jordan to the far end of Lake Kinneret as its border. Their territory extended eastward. This is the inheritance of the descendants of Gad by clans, with its cities and its villages. Moses gave inheritance to the half-tribe of Manasseh. It was for the half-tribe of the descendants of Manasseh by clans. Their territory included Machanaim and all of Bashan. That is, all the kingdom of Og, king of Bashan, all the villages of Yair in Bashan, 60 cities, half of Gilead, and Ashtaroth and Edrei, the cities of the kingdom of Og and Bashan. All this was for the descendants of Machir, the son of Manasseh, or rather for half of the descendants of Machir, by clans. These are the inheritances which Moses distributed in the plains of Moab, beyond the Jordan and Jericho, eastward. But to the tribe of Levi, Moses gave no inheritance, Adonai, the God of Israel, is their inheritance, as he told them. Now, this first verse essentially gives us the reason that the Lord was telling Joshua to distribute the land they had conquered. Joshua was old. Joshua was one of the two spies, the other one being Caleb, who had ventured along with 12 others into Canaan to scout it out, but came back with a good report, while the other 10 scouts recommended caution. They even tried to find somewhere else to call home for Israel. Therefore, Joshua was indeed pretty old, somewhere between his early 80s, perhaps 90-ish years old. Not only that, but unlike where we read in Deuteronomy that Moses was strong when he died, as he was many years earlier, here we read age had taken its toll on Joshua. Well, Moses was not a warrior, but Joshua was. Joshua fought in many battles. He lived a dangerous and a hard life. You don't fight as much as Joshua had without stress affecting you and without a litany of battle wounds. Joshua had been used and used up. Now, there is an unspoken but fairly obvious reality in play here. Since the order from Jehovah was to conquer all of Canaan, and by no means had that been accomplished yet, then Joshua probably wasn't mentally prepared to divide up that land just yet. This wasn't rebellion, it was just some reasonable logic. But the Lord wanted Joshua to be the one to supervise the division. So, with Joshua feeling the effects of old age, the father wanted this done sooner than later, lest Joshua die before the land allotment was accomplished. Further, Jehovah wanted whatever portion of the land that Israel did hold to be divided as is, and the Lord would, in his time, take care of the remainder. Now, the last half of this first verse brings us to the purpose of my comment at the beginning of this lesson today regarding generalizations. There it says, "But there is yet a great deal of land to be possessed." See, this modifies the words spoken at the end of Joshua chapter 11, verse 23, that said, Joshua took the whole land. That is, we have Joshua taking the whole land, and then just a few paragraphs later said that much land remained to be taken. I mean, this doesn't jibe until we better understand the biblical Hebrew style. Joshua taking the whole land is one of those broad generalizations that I referred to. After that comment, the writer of Joshua, often called, by the way, the compiler, since he is both anonymous and very obviously he used several sources to piece together the account of the conquest of southern and northern Canaan, well, he goes on to begin to add nuances, better defining the overall situation concerning the land. Now, one of the questions that can reasonably be asked is, why all this somewhat redundant information about borders and boundaries of these various lands taken? Then what land is going to be given to each tribe? The answer is a lot simpler than it might seem. Anyone who has purchased a home and recorded the deed knows that you receive a document that's called a property description. This property description uses several legal terms to give a precise definition of the property in question, from the state it's in, to the city, to the zip code, to the street address, to the length and width, right down to the inch sometimes, and the latitude, the longitude. The purpose is to remove any doubt as to precisely who owns that land and precisely what constitutes the land that's in question. None of these modern devices was available in the biblical era. Rivers, wells, dried up streams, well-known landmarks like a large tree or a cave or a rock outcropping, and the name of a king who ruled over the pertinent area. These were the only ways available to describe the property in question, and it worked quite well. Land disputes were common then as they are now, and these long narrative descriptions of the property were what was needed to solve most of the disputes. The problem is that over hundreds and thousands of years, rivers move or they cease to exist. Landmarks disappear. Local cities are destroyed and sometimes renamed. Kings change with regularity, and the record of the names of previous kings are often lost or intentionally modified in order to discredit a king who came into disfavor. So defining exactly where a piece of property dating back into Bible times was located, that can be pretty daunting, sometimes impossible. So verse 2 speaks of one rather infamous region that Joshua did not conquer, the land of the Philistim, the Philistines. I want to remind you of the rather interesting fact that the word Palestine is but Greek for Philistine or Philistia. And this verse makes it clear that the Israelites had no luck whatsoever in taking any part of Philistia. The region that was defined as associated with the Philistines is from the Wadi of Egypt, here called Shihor, in the south, to the border of Ekron, up into the north. And then it goes on to name the five major city-states that make up Philistia: Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gat, and Ekron. And this area lies all along the coast of Canaan, next to the Mediterranean Sea. It's a long, narrow strip that suited this group of people, who were called originally the Sea Peoples before they were known as the Philistines. Now, while nothing has been 100% proved, the overwhelming body of evidence points towards the Sea Peoples as originally coming from the area of Crete and terrorizing and then colonizing areas as far south as Egypt, as far north and east as modern-day Istanbul. Now, it's noticeable that today a lot of people mistakenly think that the Gaza Strip is the location of ancient Philistia, but it's not. In fact, Gaza City was the southernmost of the five city Philistine complex in ancient times, and today Gaza City is the northernmost major city in the so-called Gaza Strip. Ashdod and Ashkelon are well north of Gaza City, and those places are firmly in Israel's hands. The exact locations of Gat and Ekron are hotly debated. We're not certain of them. Now, Philistia had an ally at their southern border that were called the Geshurites. And the Geshurites were a minor power, and so they operated in concert with the powerful Philistines, such that even the territory that the Geshurites occupied was simply generalized as being part of Philistia. Now, technically, Philistia proper ended as you go south at Gaza City. Then the land of the Geshurites began, and it continued further south to the Wadi of Egypt. Now, this mention of a people called the Avim is thought to be referring to a remnant of the former inhabitants of the area that Philistia now occupied. So here we have a pretty well-defined area that lies along the seacoast, beginning in the Upper Sinai Peninsula at the Wadi of Egypt, extending to a little south of modern-day Ashdod, and it's dominated by a people called the Philistines. This is one of three named regions that the Israelites did not conquer under Joshua. And by the way, modern Ashdod, where of course this ministry has a teaching facility, is not exactly the same place as ancient Ashdod. Ancient Ashdod's about 3 miles or so southeast of the modern city of Ashdod, which has got to be a pretty good sized city. Now, the next major unconquered region is the northern seacoast of Canaan that is better known as Phoenicia. And again, notice that for some reason, the Israelites had at the time of Joshua either not undertaken the task or failed at taking the seacoast areas. Even though the word Phoenicia is not mentioned, the word Sidonians is. Sidon was the capital city of Phoenicia. Being the seat of government, it was common to speak of the residents of Sidon in a more general way, and at times to ascribe their name to all of Phoenicia, even though technically that's not correct. You know, I'm originally from Southern California. And even though I lived in various tiny beach areas, from Manhattan Beach all the way south to Huntington Beach, if a person who I knew wasn't terribly familiar with the area and they asked me where I was from, I'd say L.A., Los Angeles. Most people wouldn't really know where these small beach cities were if I gave them the actual beach city that I lived in. Los Angeles City itself isn't really all that big of a land area. But it is such a known name, and it's the power center of Southern California, that it best answers the question, where are you from? If you're living anywhere in that area. So you just say, L.A. It's the same thing with calling the people of Phoenicia Sidonians, because the grand city of Sidon was such a known place. Works exactly the same way. Well, the third unconquered region is described in verse 5, and it begins just above Sidon, probably at a place called Byblos, and then it stretches eastward. Lebanon refers to the mountain range in the western part of Canaan that's next to Phoenicia, and it's definitely part of the land promised to Israel through Moses. So now we have a lay of the land. And in general, the mountain and the desert regions of Israel, beginning at the Jordan River and then moving westward, were captured by Joshua, but not as far as getting to the Mediterranean Sea. The coast of the Mediterranean and the coastal plain from the Upper Sinai Peninsula in the south, running all the way north to Lebanon, remained in the hands of the enemy. Well, in verse 6, the Lord makes it clear that despite Israel holding only some of the territory, they were to immediately divide it up among the 9.5 tribes for their inheritance. God says that he in time will expel these people. I want to be clear what's happening. Once again, Joshua is old and tired. His fighting days are pretty near an end. The Lord is saying to Joshua and to Israel and to future generations not to worry. Joshua, the anointed warrior, may soon be gone, but God will remain with the people and he will continue on with the plan. It does not end with the death of Joshua. Joshua's final task is not that of war, but of the distribution of land that has been won by war. Verse 7 emphasizes that the land conquered by Joshua is only for the 9.5 tribes, because the other 2.5 have already received their land allotment at their own request outside of the promised land on the east side of the Jordan River. So starting with verse 8, after the overall territory that was now in the hands of Israel, including the land on both the east and west sides of the Jordan River, the Israelite tribes start being mentioned as associated with certain territories within these lands. They had not been up to now. Reuben, Gad, half the tribe of Manasseh are officially certified as having their land assigned to them by means of more or less repeating their boundaries. However, it's also mentioned that they didn't conquer all the land of Og and Sihon. It says that the Geshurites and the Maakites were not driven out. This is a different group of Geshurites than the ones that lived to the south of Philistia, and they were a close ally. These Geshurites live far away in the north country, to the east of the Jordan River. What interests me is the portion of the verse that says these people live among Israel to this day. Understand, This does not mean that they were assimilated. It means they kept their independence, but generally speaking, they lived side by side in peace with Israel. By all rights, the Geshurites living near Israel would have been okay with the Lord if they did so in peace. Israel was to try and make peace with nations outside of the land of Canaan, as opposed to the requirement to drive out or kill all the inhabitants inside the land of Canaan, and the northern Geshurites were outside of the land of Canaan. However, both the negative tone of the statement, the use of the Hebrew word kereb, makes it clear that these Geshurites lived not near Israel, they lived in the midst of Israel. They influenced Israel. They lived intertwined with the half-tribe of Manasseh on the east side of the Jordan, and this was never intended, for this exact thing is what would quickly lead to idol worship, intermarriage, and then eventually Israel's exile for their idolatry and for their rebellion. And we will continue with Joshua 13 next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.